ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
These glasses are always on. They have microphones, they have cameras, and they basically become face-mounted data vacuums.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
A podiatrist named Anna Baird started a shoe business 18 years ago, and it's still going, selling $76 million worth of shoes a year in Australia, the United States, and New Zealand, and it's growing rapidly. She called it Baird, B-A-R-E-D, after herself, but with a different spelling, of course. Her name's spelled B-A-I-R-D. And the shoes are designed to be both comfortable and fashionable, a gap in the market that she identified when she was working as a podiatrist. So she and her husband, Andrew, sold the house, sold her horses, borrowed some money from her parents, and went for it. Classic startup business story. But unlike most startups, it's still going, and it worked. Now her husband works for her, and Meryl Streep famously wore her shoes to the press circuit for The Devil Wears Prada 2. So here's Anna Baird, founder and CEO of Baird Footwear. G'day, Anna Baird. Thanks for joining the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the story of how you started the business. You were a podiatrist in Camberwell.
I was.
A Melbourne suburb. Why podiatry and what happened?
Why podiatry? Well, that's going way, way back. So I started the business 18 years ago, but I had been practicing as a podiatrist for about 6 years before I started the business. Why did I choose podiatry in the first place? Probably because I was a mad show jumper. I mean, eventer, so horse riding. And podiatry let me have flexibility around my riding, which is why. And I loved being a podiatrist. I really loved the conversations that you had with patients every day. But pretty soon after I started practicing as a podiatrist, I realized that there was a real gap in the market for shoes that I could recommend that I'd actually want to wear myself. You know, as podiatrists, we make a lot of orthotics, which basically, if you're a runner or you've got knee pain, podiatrists make money by prescribing these things that go into your shoes. And at the time, there was nothing in the market that actually could accommodate these orthotics, except for shoes designed for 80-plus-year-old people. So if you're seeing these young women in particular that are runners and I wanted to put something in their shoes, there was nothing in the market. So there was a clear gap in a very podiatry-specific way, which is really where I started 18 years ago. Luckily, since then, we still, the podiatry side of things, making shoes that are seriously comfortable, is still the core of the business, but we now are definitely, we're a fashion brand that makes shoes that are comfortable, quite a long way from the ugly shoes that I created 18 years ago that was slightly better than that was on the market.
Yeah, you said that it took 3 years to develop the shoe. I mean, what did that involve, developing the shoe, and were you working as a podiatrist at the same time?
Yeah, I was. I was practicing at a private practice in Camberwell. I found a factory. I'd sort of mucked around with small factories that didn't go anywhere for a couple of years. And then I found a factory in Sydney and cut back podiatry to 4 days a week. And most Mondays I'd travel to Sydney to sort of develop the range. It took about 3 years working with that factory before I had a product that I could sell.
And what was the product like? Were you happy with it?
It was really uncomfortable. It was looked marginally better than it was on the out there. But I opened a little shop in Toorak Village, and that is when my really exciting idea that I'm going to, you know, there's this gap in the market, I'm going to create these shoes, did really turn into this awful, harsh reality. You know, I'd spent all the capital on a range of shoes that were pretty shit, didn't fit very well, didn't look that great. And trying to survive at the start, I mean, I think most people that start a business will have the same horror stories, but they were really dark.
Is that when you sold your horse and sold your house and borrowed money from your parents,
yeah,
all that? I mean, was that to set up that store in Toorak?
I sold the last horse 12 months before I started the business. So that actually, the last horse that I sold actually helped fund the first the first lot of shoes that I ever ordered. So I didn't have any horses after that. I just gave up riding to start the business.
How much did you get for a horse?
Well, I was pretty good at selling horses. I had the benefit of, I think everyone knew that anything that I was riding, I would sell. I've always been interested in the dollar. So, I think the last horse I sold, and this sounds like this makes it sound very easy, but it's such an expensive sport. And now I've got a daughter riding all I do. I'm the bunny that's paying for everything rather than making money. But I think I bought this horse for 2,000 and sold for 80,000, the last horse that I
Crikey, that's not a bad investment.
That was good. But that's a rarity. Most of the time you just spend it. And now I'm the person spending all the money, and there's no way I'll ever make a dollar out of this sport anymore now that's my daughter riding.
Well, tell us about designing the first shoe and how you went about it. What made it different to other shoes?
Well, the gap was really that the shoe would have something that actually you could take out of the shoe. So that was what, as a podiatrist, I needed, something that I could put a custom orthotic in. So I'd take something out and put something in. That was a long time ago, and that's where I started. But what I developed at the time was actually an orthotic that the shoe came with. And that orthotic basically is still the same as orthotic. It's made out of a different material, but the lumps and bumps and support and density is very similar to the one that I started with 18 years ago. And that's what the base of the shoes is. So, I mean, I don't know if your listeners wanted to go into all the features of it, but it's got like a little lump at the front underneath. It's called the metatarsal dome. So underneath the metatarsals, which is sort of underneath the ball of your foot, that helps take the pressure off the ball of your foot. Cuboid notch is a funny little notch that helps to stabilize your foot. So they're technical terms, but it's basically an off-the-shelf, you know, mildly supportive orthotic that comes in every shoe. Originally, they all were removable, and in a lot of our shoes, they still are. So boots, sneakers, all men's shoes.
So you don't need to put an orthotic into the shoe. It's not designed for that. It's an orthotic in itself.
It comes with it. So most of our customers now don't have actually foot pain or orthotics. 18 years ago, that was the gap that I was trying to fill. Now they all come with this support. So really, people buy the shoes because they're really comfortable and they're supportive. And once you've worn the shoe, it's quite hard to put anything else back on. You're like, oh, this is not supportive and comfortable. So we do get this crazy loyal customer that doesn't want to wear anything else. In a lot of our shoes, it is built in. So if you buy a sandal or a heel, which you won't be, Alan, buying the heels, but then it will. The same support is in every single shoe. But in a lot of shoes, it's actually removable, which does mean that we can adjust the fit of the shoe. So when you buy a shoe online or in store and you've got a wider foot, you'll actually take the thicker footbed out, you'll put a thinner one in, which will give you a whole lot more depth and width in the shoe. If you have got a really narrow foot, the shoe actually comes with an extra little pad that you'll put underneath the footbed to actually take up room of the shoe, which means we can really effectively fit narrow or wide feet and customize it to someone in their home, which is a huge benefit for online sales. So,
But how did the business go at first? I mean, I read somewhere that you cried almost every day for 12 months.
Yeah, it was shit. It was absolutely terrible. It was just really hard. We had the shoes weren't great. We'd ran out of capital. We did sell our house and we rented it back, loaded up on credit card debt. My husband was an accountant at the time, so we could put food on the table. But it was, and I don't even know why we kept going. I think there were customers coming in, and I think from the get-go, because I was in the store 7 days a week, I knew that there was something in this. And the customer service was always good. I was in there learning what we needed to improve. I knew that I could do it, but it was early days to actually just keep it going was incredibly hard.
Your husband, Andrew, obviously backed you as well. How important was that?
Oh, I think everything, really. I think you know, everyone laughs now that he's a co-founder, and I'm like, he was not a bloody co-founder. He didn't come into this business for, you know, theoretically as the CEO. You see, he's the, what is he?
CFO.
CFO.
He's
the CFO. But he was, you know, always the CFO, even though he didn't work in the business for probably the first 7 years. But he was paying the bills and speaking to the bank and trying to keep the lights on, and really did always back, you know, me in this journey. And, yeah, so all our friends give him stick all the time that I say he's not a co-founder, because He's not product, he's not people, he's not retail, but he's numbers and I am anything but numbers. So we know our strengths, and I certainly couldn't, the business would not be what it is without him, that's for sure.
When did you decide to use the different spelling of your name as the brand?
I think years ago when I first was doing the branding, I was going to call it Baird by Baird, and they said that's a bad idea, just call it Baird. I think the spelling, I don't know, it was sort of like bare feet, even though they're not, you're putting shoes on, but that sort of comfort of bare feet, I don't know, it was just too handy to call it that.
And I mean, can you just tell us about what the last 18 years have been like broadly? I mean, has it been an up and down process? Are there any kind of moments that stand out?
I think, there's always moments that stand out. And I think, you know, the trying to stay positive in a business is really one of the reasons why it does survive. You have to stay positive. And I think learning when things are terrible, how to see the positive and the learning in it always. I think, I can give you some examples. There's plenty of them. But I think quite quickly you do need to turn around in your head and go, what's the opportunity here? And most of the time when, for example, a few years ago we introduced a bio-based footbed. So this footbed that we're just talking about was always made out of 100% polyurethane, so plastic, petroleum-based chemicals. And then I found a really innovative material that was 72% bio-based, so much better for the environment. And the first lot that we made, we put a cork top cover on, which again was better for the environment, we thought. With a cork top cover, it started peeling off within a few days of wear. So we'd sold thousands of these shoes and it was pretty disastrous. But rather than it being a complete, it was disastrous, but it really gave us an opportunity to contact all of those people, bring them on the journey, apologize, get them an alternative footbed, and make sure that they knew the reason why we're doing this, why they had a problem with their shoe. We had website crashes where we overcharged thousands of people numerous times. We'd had thousands of dollars of people's money. And again, total nightmare, could have really damaged the brand. But actually, in the end, I think we managed to turn it around and make them positive experiences because we literally called everyone, apologized, told them what we were doing. So people expect you to have integrity, not necessarily be perfect.
A lot of people talk about the valley of death. Entrepreneurs talk about the valley of death, which is about cash flow. How did you go with cash flow, particularly in the early days?
That's why we're alive, because that's a question for Andrew.
All right.
How did we go with cash flow? I think that's why I was really lucky, because he was across the cash flow from day one. We always, the business... Yeah, we borrowed lots of money. Not lots of money. We borrowed enough to get the next order and keep ourselves alive. And then for a long time, we have been a really profitable business as well. I think we've always made sure that we're profitable. We haven't had to keep going back to the bank or get investors on board.
When did you decide to get the shoes made in China, and was that hard to find a factory?
It wasn't hard to find a factory, but it was – so I always thought we were going to manufacture in Australia. I wanted to manufacture in Australia. And after about 4 years, the quality of the shoes that we were getting here and the price you had to pay just wasn't there. We were having to charge them $400 for a shoe in Australian dollars that was probably – worth 200. We didn't have the craftsmen left in this country. So sadly, that is just the reality. Manufacturing footwear in this country in scale at all is actually impossible. So moved offshore to China, which really was game changing, because it meant that we could develop the range. We could actually not, if we wanted to do a moccasin upper, and it became much easier to do the fashion side of the business. We weren't locked into, you'd spend a whole lot of really expensive tooling in Australia. You just couldn't expand the range. So China was game changing. Yes, for margins a bit, but we spent a lot of money on our shoes in China, and the quality is amazing. We've worked with the same factory for 15 years now, and it's great partnerships that we have with our, and we spend a lot on the manufacturing and on these materials that now we're trying to source the world for the greenest materials in the world, which are seriously expensive.
How important is that sustainability angle for your brand?
If for my brand, for the customer, not important. I don't think they really care, to be honest. I think they buy our shoes because they look great. We make a really desirable fashion product that is really comfortable, and we really look after customers. That's why what the brand is, which is fine. But as a business, we are, you know, we are in this really polluting environment. There's 23 billion pairs of shoes get thrown out every year. Most of them are made from petrochemicals. They're plastic. They last a long time. Even if it says rubber, it's usually 70% plastic. It's not actually natural rubber. And people, they don't last forever. So they go into landfill. They're there for hundreds of years, you know, break down to microplastics, which is, you know, we're one part of the problem, which is, as a brand, the last probably 7 years been investing really heavily trying to find bio-based materials, or at least materials at end of life break down without any microplastics. So lazy people can actually throw this shoe out and it won't be around in hundreds of years. So it's, the customers don't care, we care, and I think, you know, maybe in 5 years' time they'll start to care and we'll be a better business for it, but it does feel like the right thing to do.
The other challenge for entrepreneurs is finding the right people to hire. So in a speech you gave on International Women's Day, you told the story of the Baird shop manager giving notice when your baby was only four days old, and you said that if this had happened when the baby was any older, you'd probably have gone back into the shop yourself, but instead you had to hire and hire well so the business could run without you for a while. So how's that gone over the years? How have you gone about hiring, and have you hired well?
Definitely hired well. I wish I could say it can run without me, but I have got an incredible team of people, and a lot of them have been there for over 15 years. And I, you know, I did steal this from someone years ago, but when people do ask who trains your team, my answer is that their parents do. And we have the best people to look after people. But we also have this great, you know, I hate the word culture, but it is a culture that people are really empowered. They choose their own careers. So our COO is the girl that, when I had a four-day-old baby, actually left the business for 4 years. She's been back for 10 years. She's an integral part of the business. Our sort of head of creative has been with me for, I think, about 17 years. These women both have two children of their own. Our head of warehouse has been with us for 12 years, is about to have a baby. I can go on and on about the women that have been predominantly women that are now senior people in the business that started on the shop floor and have grown the business to what it is. And it is, the business is theirs just as much as it is mine. And the best thing is they grow the people around them. They instill everything that makes Baird great. They bring everyone on the journey. So we've got an amazing team. I'm really proud of the tenure of our team, and, you know, they're very invested.
And tell us about the business now. What does it look like? What are your sales in total? The growth rate, margin, number of stores, employees? Just give us a bit of a profile of the business as it stands.
Snapshot, we're turning over, I think, about 76 million. The US we've only been really leaning into in the last 2 years, but its growth rate in the last 6 months is about 80%. So it's now doing about 12 million. So it's about 15% of the business, which is where we're trying to really lean into at the moment. We've got 7 stores, physical stores, 6 in Australia, 1 in Auckland. We will be looking at opening another one back in New York. I'm just actually looking again now. A few retail sites have just come through, which is exciting. We need another one in Sydney. So the retail, our omni-channel customer is really important to us. So people that shop in our stores and online are our most loyal and valuable customers. So the bricks and mortar is a really important part of the business. I don't have any intention of rolling out hundreds of stores. We have destination sites that are really unique spaces with really, really fantastic people in them. I don't like shopping centres, low ceiling. I don't like just being like any other shoe brand. So they are quite unique spaces. And any stores that we do roll out will hopefully have that same formula. I don't plan on mass rollout.
Do you have in your mind the lifetime value of an omni-channel customer?
I've actually got it in numbers, but I don't have it with me right here. But the omni-channel customer is by far the most valuable customer, those that shop in-store and online. And we've always known if we can get someone to their third purchase within a certain amount of time, then we've got them for life. They just keep purchasing. So it's how you get them past that first purchase. What was that shoe? What's the second shoe? And once you get them into a third, then you've basically got them hooked. So it is a huge part of our marketing is how we get them in the right shoes to begin with so that they stay with us.
So what proportion of your sales are online?
65%. So obviously the US for that 12 million is about 95%. We've got a little tiny concessiony sort of store sort of thing happening in Soho in New York at the moment. But yeah, in Australia, it's about 65% online.
Do you get many returns from online sales? People, because they didn't fit or something?
Huge. I think US in particular, which is a nightmare, is about 40% returns. And that's across, like footwear is a nightmare. So China, that's a huge focus for us now, right now, how we get the sizing more accurate for someone in the US that's not used to our sizing as well. So a huge problem. What we have always done, and it does really work, is send someone a shoe. If it doesn't work, we'll get them to hang on to the shoe, send them two more pairs to try for free, and then send back anything or all if they don't work. It's really logistically expensive, time consuming, but it actually does. If someone does try three pairs of shoes, the chance of them keeping one is actually quite high, especially if they've had a great service with, they've spoken to someone over the phone or the it's all been really smooth sailing. The chance of them keeping one's quite high, and then we've got them potentially for life. So, yeah, online is a huge cost and a huge logistics nightmare, but it is it's a really great part of the business as well.
How important in the US was the thing about Meryl Streep wearing your shoes for the Devil Wears Prada 2 press circuit? How did that come about?
It comes about, I think those things, you basically get stylists involved. You know, we use some PR agencies over in the US. So you get a stylist to give them some shoes, and if they happen to be styling these superstars and they choose your shoe, you get them on these incredible people. So Meryl Streep, I mean, I think the team, so many of my friends and the whole team were so excited to having Meryl Streep. And obviously it was the perfect timing right when the world was watching her. So, and she wore a, you know, studded, really obvious boot, which also makes it handy rather than it looking like every other shoe. But my thing that I actually really do think is I want her to love the comfort of the shoe. So I'll be excited if Meryl's like, oh, actually, what were those shoes? Can you get me another pair? Which I don't think has happened yet. So that's when I'll be really excited, is that you actually get her to love the comfort and want another pair.
But I mean, how important is social media marketing to you? How did you go about marketing for the whole time? And what's been your marketing strategy?
Marketing strategy is always to make sure that we're fashion first, because we come from, you know, I was a podiatrist. There's nothing more daggy than podiatrists starting a business. So we don't want people thinking, oh, great, I'll tell my mom or my grandma about your product. So to create a fashion brand, social media has been huge. It's a visual medium. And we've just got really talented creative people, as I was saying, ahead of creative. We did the same photography course about 16 years ago, and I can't take a photo, and now she does all our photography and styling. Really talented girl. And yeah, we make a great fashion shoe. So I think the desirability of the shoe is there. And then people, once they know it's comfortable, they give themselves the permission to buy. So social media is huge. And now it's TikTok. And we have a really great team of young creatives that work in the business, making sure that we are, you know, up there as a international fashion brand.
You feel like telling us what your margin is?
That's a question for Andrew. I'm not interested in the numbers. I just sell good shoes and look after people. I'd be lying if I told you the margin. So
right,
I fair can't.
Enough. No, fair enough. That's okay. Tell us about your decision to sell part of the business to Brett Blundy, the big retail investor.
Brett, so I think that happened in 2019, and I just got an email one day from someone that was working for his fund. And we weren't looking at doing anything, but I read the email and then just looked on the website to see, check out what they were. And actually I went to Brett's culture commitments. He's got 10 plus one culture commitments. They're the values that, you know, he has ran his businesses by in the past and continues to today, and the ones that he's involved in. And I felt like I could have written them myself. I thought it was exactly the reasons why my business had been to the success that it had been to that stage, which was a lot smaller then than it is now. And so then we had a meeting with this chap, and I just really liked them as people, which sounds random. And anyone in there's like, they'll move. You can't trust anyone. This is a bad decision. Blah, blah. But the investment was just off the table. I didn't ever commit to grow. I didn't commit to doing anything. They bought a third of the business and we just took money to de-risk our life, which has been a great decision. They've been, you know, great partners. They're sort of, they're not silent, but they are, you know, they let us do what we want. But also if I want Brett or his sister Tracy or Joe, who's on our board, at any time, they're there with their knowledge and experience. So we run our own show, but you know that you've got, if you do need advice, there's someone there. But it's been a great partnership.
How much did they pay for a third?
They paid, I think, $11 million at the time.
Right. And that's probably been a decent investment since in the past 6 years, hasn't it?
Yeah. They've done quite well, and we pay lots of big dividends to them too. So I think we're a tiny business for them, the fact that they're even interested in us to start with. And again, we haven't been bulgy in our growth. You know, we haven't opened hundreds of stores or done it the way that they, have done in the past. But it works for them. But we're a tiny business compared to everything else that they invest in.
Yeah, but you're growing quickly. I mean, what are your future plans? Does Brett Blundy want you to list, or do you want to list the company on the stock market? No.
No, I won't list it. No.
You won't list it. No intention to do that.
No. I think I like the stress being my own stress. I don't like other people. And I think even when we bought Brett on, that was my thing. If it's going badly, if it's going well, then it's our team that, that's what's keeping me up at night, not anything else. So, no, I've got no interest in listing it.
So what's your vision for 5 years? I mean, is it you mainly in 5 years or 10 years are mainly an American business based here in Australia? How do you see it?
I don't know. It's so funny. I've never been great at goal setting or all these things, fail to plan, you plan to fail, all that stuff. I've never planned anything. I've just done what my gut has said feels right. And I change my mind all the time, which to the annoyance of my team. But the US, it is working. It makes sense that we sort of lean into that for the next few years. I'm really keen on the UK. I think our customer is... and our customer service would really resonate over there. It's growing with really very little activations just through Meta and Google. So I'd love to open something in London as well, but the team keeps telling me to shut up and just let us do the US for now. So the US is certainly the focus for the next, at least 12 months. But and also not forgetting about our customer here. Like there's growth. It's sort of interesting because I think if you ask people in Australia, have they heard of Baird? They either have heard of us, they've got five pairs, they love it, they can tell you all these great stories about the customer service, or they've never heard of us. So there's still growth potentially in Australia if we keep making great product and looking after people.
I think you opened a store in Auckland, didn't you?
Yes. We did that. It must be 2 years ago.
Right.
And that's a beautiful store. It's growing all the time. Poor Auckland hasn't had the best time economy-wise, but it is getting better all the time, that store actually. So it has, it's good. It's not shooting the lights out, but I think poor Auckland is not shooting the lights out on many levels right now.
Are you having to deal with copycats, other companies that are sort of branding themselves as podiatry shoes?
Yes, and we always have. We've had competitors from the day that we started. And it is, I have this sort of funny analogy, but I think it's one of these things trying to find positive when you see people coming up and trying to copy you. And I was at school, I was quite a good breaststroker. And I remember I was very used to winning all my races. And I remember one time there was a girl next to me, and every breath I started looking sideways at her. And I lost the race, which I wasn't used to doing. I remember at the end of the pool, my coach, screaming at me saying, "You'll never win a race looking sideways." And it has sort of stuck with me. You've got to swim your own race. You've got to do it your way. So I think there are competitors. I think we need to stay at the front because we make a really great fashion quality product out of better materials and a brand that actually cares about doing stuff other than making money. And we really, really look after customers. We have these great relationships with people. We really don't leave them in shoes if they're not really happy. And that is not just something that we say, it is something that we really do. So Yeah, there'll be competitors. I have got a healthy paranoia always that we're not doing enough, not with product, not with customer service, not that we're not cool enough, we're not fast enough, we're not doing enough with AI, which we are. But, you know, the healthy paranoia runs throughout the business from me, I think, because I am scared the whole time that we will slip. So I never sit on our laurels. We're never doing enough or good enough, but also you've got to do it your way.
How does it go working with your husband? Are you the CEO?
No, I'm the CEO. Yes, he's very compliant. Yes, no. Andrew, I mean, we've been together since I was 19. I'm now 48, so it's, I don't know, almost 30 years. He's put up with me for a long time, so we know how to work together. We're like literally together the whole time. But yeah, we've got this great life. I've got two kids. Our son is 17, our daughter is almost 15. And, you know, running your own business with all the stresses, you also have a whole lot of flexibility. So we do spend a lot of time, you know, at our beach house or with friends and traveling. And so, you know, we work really well together. I think he knows. Yeah. Yeah. 30 years, it's a long time.
Sounds great. thanks for speaking to us, Anna.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining me on That's Business. You can find That's Business in the ABC Business Daily feed every Friday. And so you don't miss out, make sure you follow ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Carrington Clark will be back in the ABC Business Daily feed on Monday.